Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday morning. The Kyoto Protocol, which was signed, is the only international treaty to set legally binding targets on cutting greenhouse emissions. The governments of almost 200 countries are meeting this week in Doha, Qatar, to discuss a new treaty that will succeed Kyoto, which expires at the end of this year. So, what will be the items on the agenda? Who is at this meeting? What could be the goals for reducing emissions? Why have other international gatherings like this been less than really successful, but have they been successful in certain areas? We're going to talk about this important meeting this hour of the program with David Hunter. He's assistant professor of law and director of the environmental law program at American University's Washington College of Law, where he teaches U.S. environmental law, international environmental law, comparative environmental law, and the law of torts. He has written the leading textbook in the field, International Environmental Law and Policy. We'll be welcoming phone calls this hour, as we always do. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. What about the United States? The president mentioned during his acceptance speech for the nomination to be second-term president that he was going to do something about climate change. Is there some signal that the United States could be sending this conference, should be sending this conference, to show that we are serious about climate change? Here's our phone number for you to join our conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, and you can always leave messages for us on the Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. David Hunter, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello, Kathleen. It's my pleasure to be there.
Tell me a little bit, we'll have to do it somewhat briefly, but these meetings have been going on for some period of time now. Tell me what progress internationally in terms of legally binding treaties have we made over the course of the past 15 years?
Well, we've made some progress, but of course not enough to address climate change. And you're right, these meetings, the latest one going on now in Doha, are an annual event that date back really 20 years to 1992, when the world met at the Earth Summit and agreed to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. And that convention, to which almost all the world's countries are parties, including the United States, that convention really sets out the framework for the negotiations of climate change that continue to this day. It shapes the way the negotiations go forward, and it's really the institution provides the institutional architecture for these negotiations. And the meeting this week and next week is really a meeting of the Conference of the Parties, the member governments of that convention. The Kyoto Protocol that you mentioned as well was negotiated under the general auspices of this convention. It was negotiated in 1997. And the parties are also meeting to continue the Kyoto Protocol process.
Mm-hmm. And that framework that was put together all those years ago, what is that framework?
So the Framework Convention did a number of important things. The first thing that it did not do was it did not set any specific binding targets for reductions of greenhouse gases, of carbon dioxide and the other gases that cause climate change. And nobody thinks that it did. But what it did do is the convention set out a general objective that still guides our negotiations today. And that objective is to avoid dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate change. Well, what does that mean? It means to avoid significant man-made impacts on our long-term climate, on our weather. And so that's what our goal is in these negotiations, is to avoid these very significant impacts. It also set out, in addition to the institutional framework, the idea that we would meet every year as a conference of governments to try to progress this complex issue forward. It also set out a very important set of principles, and I think I want to mention one which really still explains the politics today. And that principle is called the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities. And what that principle said, in short, was it said that the developing countries, that all countries would consider climate change important, but that the industrialized countries, the United States, Europe, Japan, they needed to go first in addressing climate change for two major reasons. One, that the industrialized countries, remember we're thinking back in 1992, were the primary cause of climate change. It was our emissions that were the enormous proportion of all emissions of greenhouse gases. So the world agreed that we, the industrialized countries, the United States and Europe, should take the leadership role. And the second reason is because we were wealthier, frankly, and some of that wealth, the argument goes, was based on the fact that we were able to emit and industrialize, and the other countries were coming along later, and they should be allowed to industrialize and use the same kind of energy sources, so that we would need to reflect this wealth and provide some of the financing and funding. Everybody would participate, but Europe and the U.S., because we were most responsible for it, would lead. That principle now doesn't hold quite so clearly, because in the last few years, China has become the greatest emitter, and India is number four on the emission list, the United States is number two, Europe is number three of annual emissions today. So the U.S. and others are saying that principle shouldn't dictate what we do, and we should all take a shared interest in addressing this.
Mm-hmm. Go back to what you said a little bit earlier, that we need to, an overall goal is that we need to avoid significant man-made impacts. Did we identify what those were?
We have been identifying them, and one area that has really progressed over the last 20 years is to continue to look at the science of climate change and the impacts that we're going to expect. Back 20 years ago, our models predicted much of what we're seeing today, and we don't even have to predict it anymore. We're seeing the impacts of climate change even as we speak. And those impacts are fairly dramatic, and they get worse if we don't do anything about climate change. So the impacts are, first, a warming planet. We've seen temperatures increase a little bit over a degree Fahrenheit, and the projections, if we do nothing right now, are that average temperatures will increase 7 degrees Fahrenheit. Everybody likes it warmer, at least to a point. So to some extent, people say, well, what's so bad about that? The problem is that global average masks some very significant impacts on climate change. Increased heat is like increased energy in the atmosphere. We can expect more and more intensive storms, greater droughts, more flooding, melting of the polar ice caps. And we're seeing all of these things that are consistent with what will happen over the long term with climate change. And if we go on the projection that we're going, these impacts are going to be extremely serious.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about funding, was there something that everybody signed to saying that the greatest emitters at that time, Europe and the United States particularly, would be helping developing countries with a certain amount of money to make sure that they were clean in their rush to give everybody power and cars, et cetera?
There wasn't any specific amount agreed to in the early years. But beginning in particularly in 2009, under this principle that industrialized countries should help out, the industrialized countries promised $30 billion in this time period up until 2020. And then we've promised $100 billion a year starting in 2020 to address both the impacts of climate change and to help resolve climate change. And so the money is a very important part of the discussions today as well as through the last decade or so.
Mm-hmm. What else is an important part of the discussions?
Today, the important part of the discussions are, first, how we're going to move to a time when all countries are agreeing to some binding commitments. We don't have a clear roadmap for how countries with vastly different economies are going to come to agreement to a consensus about what kind of caps or controls they're going to put on their emissions. So that's one big issue. We don't expect that to be resolved in Doha this week or next week, but we do hope that there will be some baby steps towards that discussion. I can talk about that in a little bit. The other issue that will be on the agenda this week and next week is what you mentioned in the lead-in, which is the second round of the Kyoto Protocol. So, and that the Kyoto Protocol, which was adopted in 1997, The industrialized countries did what they said they would do 10 years earlier in 1992 or 5 years earlier. They took the lead. And Europe, the United States, and Japan negotiated the protocol, which led to a binding cap on emissions, where on average the industrialized countries would reduce their emissions 5% from 1990 levels. And that reduction was supposed to take place between the years 2008 and 2012. The United States would subsequently withdraw from the Kyoto Protocol and wouldn't ever ratify it, but the other countries, most of them, would go forward. If you check out that date, the reporting period for Kyoto Protocol ends in 2012, and so those countries that are participating in it need a second round, and that second round is part of what we hope will happen in these negotiations.
And refresh our memories, why didn't we sign on to that?
Well, we did originally sign on to it. It was negotiated with the active participation of the United States. But then when George W. Bush came in 2000, he withdrew our signature, essentially, and announced that we would not try to ratify the agreement, essentially repudiated the Kyoto Protocol, on basically two ostensible grounds. One, that we wouldn't be a party to an agreement that didn't include binding targets on China or India, which is why I mentioned that principle back in 1992. Mm-hmm. The idea for the global community was that we would go first, and then China and India would come back later. So we somewhat rejected that in 2000 and said we want a global set of binding agreements on China and India. And the second reason was cost, that it was viewed as too costly. And that's really probably the most important reason, was that that administration, the Bush administration, was not committed to an international response to climate change. And so they withdrew on the grounds of cost and that China wasn't participating. But we should say that it was a big step back for the international diplomacy. Not only did we drop out of Kyoto, but we really didn't offer any alternative for the next 3 to 4 years. It wasn't until his second term that he started negotiations with China and India. So that really slowed the negotiations. And one thing we should ask ourselves is, would we be in a different negotiating position today if we could say to China and India, we lived up to our parts of the Kyoto Protocol, we being the United States? Mm-hmm. Europe did live up to that part, as did Australia and a few other countries.
Mm-hmm. Did we, though, achieve a 5% reduction in emissions during 2008 to 2012?
No, we did not. It's a little bit confusing because of the baseline. Our commitment was to reduce below 1990 levels, and we've really seen an increase since then of about 10%. So we're down, you know, from what we would have been committing under Kyoto, we're probably around 15 to 17% over what we would have done if we'd complied with Kyoto. On the other hand, we made a new commitment in the Copenhagen Accord to bring in another agreement, which was agreed to in 2009. And there we agreed to cut our emissions 17%, but from a different baseline, 2005. And we agreed to do that by 2015, and we're actually, or by 2020, sorry, and we're actually about halfway there. So we have cut emissions since the 2005 benchmark.
Mm-hmm. Has there been any indication that President Obama does plan to act on climate change? And is there something that he and the United States could do at this global warming summit in Doha to indicate that we are serious about this, if we are serious about it?
Well, I think we are serious about it. There's a, and I think that there has been some signals that the United States continues to be serious about it. Certainly, as you mentioned, President Obama mentioned climate change in his speech after Hurricane Sandy, which many people see Hurricane Sandy as being consistent with what we would expect more commonly in the future from climate change. And the devastating impacts of Hurricane Sandy have made many people realize that the future under climate change is going to be come with a lot of events like that. So that was encouraging. It encouraged environmentalists and others. And the Obama administration has taken some steps during its first 4 years, including improving energy efficiency standards for cars and trucks. It's taken some steps to begin to regulate carbon. But absent federal legislation, it's hard to see how they can take a major step. And that really affects the negotiations, because most of the countries who are negotiating with the United States don't really believe that the United States can pass significant climate legislation. And I think that limits how much we can do or how much we can promise to do.
Mm-hmm. And before we go to phone calls, what about China? What does China want from this conference?
Well, China wants a couple of things. Number one, they have significant economic growth going on still in China, and they want to ensure that they can continue that economic growth. So they're unwilling to accept a binding cap, overall cap on their emissions. What they have agreed to is a standard that would call on them to improve the efficiency of their economy, the sort of what we call the carbon intensity, how much carbon dioxide they emit per dollar of GDP. That would allow them to continue to grow their economy while still participating, they would argue, in the solution to climate change by improving their efficiency. It's just that their overall emissions would continue to grow, and they say they expect their overall emissions to continue to grow as long as their until their GDP has started to get closer to that of the West.
Mm-hmm.
And that will be an enormous amount of greenhouse gas emissions to absorb.
We welcome phone calls. We have a lot of people who would like to speak to the issue, and we'll go to you momentarily. We're talking about the 2012 United Nations Climate Change Conference, which opened on Monday of this week in Doha, Qatar. We're looking at the history of environmental treaties and what it is hoped that people will accomplish at this particular meeting, which lasts for 2 weeks, and the participants are discussing a new treaty to succeed Kyoto, which expires at the end of this year. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org. The Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also tweet if you would like to do that at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our two of our program this Tuesday, Doc Severinsen will be joining us. He's with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, conducting it this weekend in a series of holiday concerts, and also the new president, who is also was for many years the principal trumpeter for the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, Mark Niehaus, will be with us. So that's coming up, hour number two. Let's go to phone calls. Our number again, 800-486-8655. David Hunter is our guest, assistant professor of law and director of the environmental law program at American University's Washington College of Law. David in Oregon is our first caller. Hi, David.
Good morning. Thank you. The guest noted that legislation in the Congress is probably necessary in order to make significant next steps, with the Republicans in all likelihood in control of the U.S. House in 2020 because of gerrymandering and a very close numbers otherwise. I guess I would remind the listeners and then ask our guest the fact that Ronald Reagan, of all people in the mid-80s, when confronted with the science, then signed off on an international treaty that addressed the issue of the ozone depletion through the fluorocarbons. So my question or comment would be that hopefully today's Republicans would they believe in science when they get on an airplane, they believe in science when they make cell phone calls. Let's hope that they hark back to Ronald Reagan, believe in science, and act in a fashion that can address this. That's interested in the guest's comments.
Professor Hunter.
Well, I'd first say that you're absolutely right that we need a bipartisan effort to address climate change, and we need that effort to be driven by science. And the science on climate change is very clear that humans are causing it, and that the impacts are going to be devastating to many economies, including our own economy, if we don't take significant steps. And so you're right that we do need to science to continue to drive the process, and for both parties to take this seriously. I should add that any binding treaty needs to be ratified through the U.S. Senate. So it's not just that we need federal legislation. It's that that for us to negotiate a treaty, that means that we have to go through the Senate for ratification, and that's going to require bipartisan support, and that's going to require us to shift the political tides. And there has been, historically, Republican support for many environmental initiatives, and we need to build that support again.
Do you worry at all? There have been some who have said, we really need these treaties right now, that we're seeing the effects in a very dramatic fashion in terms of the glaciers melting, in terms of the weather, the droughts, the hurricanes in various parts of the world, that the evidence is here, and we're a little bit slow to take action here. Do you think that we need to, as a world body, take action, and is there anything that can move the world to take action just a little more quickly?
Well, I think the thing that moves the world to take action is unfortunately, that the science is getting worse. I mean, all the predictions of what climate change would do, most of them have underestimated the speed and rate at which we would be seeing changes in the planet. And events like Hurricane Sandy, although it's probably not correct to attribute directly that event to climate change, it is true that those are consistent with what we will see. And those kinds of events get us talking about climate change. And I think as the science gets worse, the political will build to do more. I do worry that the process of getting 180 or 200 countries to agree to something as complex as climate change is a slow process. And I think that's why we see these negotiations taking on maybe a dual nature. One is the discussion about a global binding treaty or instrument of some sort, and the other is just discussion of countries agreeing to do things. And this shift really happened in Copenhagen in 2009, led by the United States and others, where they said, essentially what you just said, Kathleen, that we can't wait for us all to agree on a complicated agreement. Surely we as countries can agree to do some things now. And all countries who agree with that, here's a pencil, go up to the board and commit to what you're willing to do. And that's where the United States committed to cutting their emission reduction 17% by 2020, and we're doing that. That's where China agreed to improve their energy efficiency, and they're doing that. The problem with that group of commitments is that the science is telling us that if we added up all those commitments made under that process, we still aren't sufficient to avoid that goal of serious climate impacts, to make sure that we don't have too much of an increase in temperature. And so we label that the ambition gap, and there will be a lot of discussion in Doha these 2 weeks about how we can improve our ambition as a world to do more, even if we don't have a binding agreement, or even pending this binding agreement, which will, at the best, take a few more years.
Mm-hmm. Charlie in Madison, hi. Charlie, hi.
Hi, how's it going today?
All right, how are you?
Good. I got a question on, I know as far as like the vehicle-related stuff and emissions-wise, how come the United States and other countries have to be so good with their emissions and others can do whatever they want? I know as far as vehicles go, there are diesels that can get way better mileage because of the emissions restrictions are lifted from them. I don't understand that. And also with aircraft, all the airplanes that are flying around in a day, and how many gallons of fuel those use. And I don't understand those emissions. I'm not too familiar with them, but I don't think there's much for emissions on aircraft.
David.
Well, those are good questions, Charlie. First, with respect to vehicles and emission standards. They haven't been the subject of international negotiations yet. Perhaps they could be, but they are certainly, as the United States takes steps domestically and as Europe has taken steps, we hope we can both transfer that policy idea as well as the technology to other countries to help them do the same thing with their emissions. But countries are reluctant to negotiate things like vehicle emission standards and things that are considered domestic. They're reluctant to negotiate those internationally, and it's not just the other countries. The United States is reluctant as well. In fact, with respect to airplane emissions, the European Union has been trying, some would say unilaterally, but been trying to bring the emissions of aircraft from international flights from the United States or from China that land in Europe, they've been trying to regulate those emissions to sort of charge and count those emissions towards their caps. And the U.S. has balked at that. They want a different agreement on air emissions. So there are ways that we can improve the efficiency of aircraft, and the newest aircraft are much more efficient. And there's also ways that we could bring those emissions into the global system. But in this case, the United States is resisting the international standard setting, and then, or at least under that formula. And other countries are resisting the imposition of international vehicle standards. And you start to see the complexity of these negotiations if you and why the United States and some other countries are saying we need broad standards with flexibility about how countries will implement it.
Thanks, Charlie, very much for the call. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In this hour of the program, we're talking about an important conference that began yesterday in Doha, Qatar, governments of 200 countries meeting to discuss a new treaty to succeed the Kyoto Treaty, which expires at the end of this year. Do we have, David, international agreements in other areas that we can see as a model for climate change treaties, mutual security, trade perhaps, that have a framework that we may want to model?
Yes, there are models. And in fact, the framework for addressing climate change was modeled after the Montreal Protocol on ozone depletion, which I think David, an earlier caller, had mentioned, was negotiated primarily under the Reagan administration. And that convention helped us to phase out chemicals that were depleting the ozone layer, and incidentally, some of those chemicals that were potent climate change gases. So the Montreal Protocol has been very effective at helping to reduce the threat from climate change as well. And that framework was similar to what we were trying to and are trying to negotiate here under the Kyoto Protocol, a global cap and phase out of some of these pollutants. I think when you look beyond the environment to things like in trade or into weapons or things like that, there are models that we can choose from. But the big issue is, do we have the political will in this area to be able to take the stronger steps? It's not really a failure of knowing what to do or how to structure the agreement. It's really a failure of diplomacy, because the complexity and the sort of interests of different countries are so disparate in this area that it's very hard to reach consensus.
Mm-hmm. Well, you almost need, I'm wondering if there are any visionaries here who are able to go to these conferences and capture the hearts and souls and the concern for future generations of all the people who are participating. In some ways, it's that kind of conversation, isn't it? That we really need to have this happen, or our world will be altered, at the risk of not being too alarmist about this. But there are huge consequences here.
No, you can't be too alarmist about climate change, to be quite honest. When you start to look at the long-term impacts of the current projections, the World Bank just came out with a report projecting that we were on a trend for about a 7-degree increase in Fahrenheit increase in warming around the planet. And when you look at the impacts of that, vast areas of coastal areas become virtually uninhabitable, where millions and millions of people live. And look at the impact on Lower Manhattan of Hurricane Sandy. These are the kinds of flooding and impacts that are going to become all too commonplace around the world. And the droughts that have hit several areas of the world this year that have caused food prices to increase. This is just a taste of what will happen as we go forward if we're not able to bend this curve of warming. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, we do need leadership in this way. And I have to say that, you know, different people have stepped forward and provided that in various amounts. I think Al Gore, as he was going around and talking about the science of climate change, was able to provide some leadership on this. There was great hope leading up to the climate conference in Copenhagen that President Obama, newly elected and having just won the Nobel Prize himself, would step forward and be seen as a moral leader on this. But I don't think he was able to do that. There are many voices in civil society that are calling for greater climate change, and some of them are being able to rally. But I think you're right. We do need this kind of leadership to both talk about the urgency, but also about the promise that we can do this. I mean, there is some reason to be optimistic that we can solve this problem through new technologies and through changes in our energy mix and things like mm-hmm. that.
What about Cristina Figueres, the new the UN's chief climate change diplomat? Is she an important figure here?
Absolutely. And she comes out of Costa Rica, which has had a long history of being a leader on environmental and social issues. And she's been a very important voice. She's the head of the Secretariat for the Framework Convention on Climate Change. And so she's part of the host of these committees and is an important voice and a consistent voice on the importance of taking immediate action. She's in a delicate position, of course, because the major economies, China, India, the United States, and Europe, they don't have consensus on how to go forward. So she both has to be a leader and she also has to be a diplomat.
And what about this having this conference in Qatar, which is, it's been criticized because they owe their enormous amounts of wealth to their enormous amounts of gas and oil. And my understanding is they emit more greenhouse gases per capita than any other nation.
Yes, there is some irony there, isn't there?
Yes, there is.
I think that... Well, I'll say this. I mean, I think that the conferences move from country to country, and the host countries are very important for that year of the conference. And so we had the conference last year in South Africa. This year it's in Doha. And it moves from region to region. It's important to have this conference in the Middle East and to have it in an area that has owed its wealth to oil. Because at least it shows that they're accepting the need to address climate change. And the Middle Eastern oil countries have long been an obstacle to progress. And I'm not sure that will completely change, but at least it's recognizing that we have to address this issue. And I wouldn't make too much of it one way or the other. This is an important meeting, but it's really, in addition to ending the, or to having to negotiate a second round of Kyoto, the other part of this is really a stepping stone to, in part of a timeline that the countries agreed to last year, which is to reach a global agreement. Because remember, in Kyoto, it's really just now about 30 industrialized countries that have agreed to a cap. So the second round of Kyoto will really only address those countries. The broader agreement, which is needed, is one that includes China, India, and the United States. Mm-hmm. And that's really on a two-year stepping stone of negotiations to culminate in 2015. And so we have a couple years to build that political will, to shift the politics here in the United States, and to begin kind of moving the country towards a broader consensus by 2015.
Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I wanted to make two. I have two important goals. One is to give people a general website which deals with this and many other issues. George Lakoff, Lakoff, a little blue blog, which covers this and other issues very well, and also gives people, importantly, words to frame the issue to best sell it to the public. And secondly, just to give people a perspective on the enormity of the problem. Because the global waters are being heated more extensively, of course, this leads to all sorts of side effects, ferocious storms, fires and droughts, which impact us. And it's indicated on this blog that we're creating the equivalent of several atomic bombs every day in terms of the heat variation, and that if we get to 2 degrees Celsius, that we're going to be at a disaster level where we can't sustain the Earth, and we're already at 0.8 degrees, according to them. And the final point I'd make is, imagine how concerned you'd be if your home was surrounded by 5 feet of water. You know, you'd consider yourself in desperate straits. Well, a projection is that if we get to the 2 degrees Celsius increase in temperature, that the oceans will rise 45 feet 45 feet. Imagine that. So we really are very close to disaster, and we must take strong measures to overcome this.
David.
Yes, we are close to disaster. I mean, the science, as I say, has been accelerating in our understanding of the impacts of climate change, and it's accurate that we've already baked in 0.8 degrees Celsius increase, and the global political consensus is that we need to limit that increase to 2 degrees to have a good chance of avoiding the worst impacts. The large amount of sea level rise is still somewhat uncertain at how much we'll get in at what temperature, because it will depend on the melting of the Greenland ice shield and ice sheet and the West Antarctic ice sheet and other things to get the very, very large increases. But even if that doesn't happen for another 100 years, or even if we avoid that, we're seeing significant sea level rise. This is going to lead to greater storm surges and incredible flooding.
Dave in Eau Claire, hi.
Thanks for taking my call, Kathleen. Uh-huh. I have a couple points. One is, when cap and trade was discussed and attempted to be passed in our Congress, the United States Department of Agriculture did a study on what its impact would be on agriculture, and it determined that 59 million acres in America would be idled and turned over to forests. And some people might think that's a good thing, but the bottom line is we have to double food production by 2050. That's what the United Nations says. Or else there'll be hundreds of millions of people that will not have enough, tens of millions that will certainly starve. And if we institute things like this, we'll just export that food production to places where regulations aren't going to be followed through. And, you know, if you look, too, at the most recent data set, the last 15 years, there's actually been global cooling. And, you know, people, Kathleen, I really encourage you to get an opposing view on here. I really don't hear it. And obviously, you're siding with your guest. And I don't think that's right on public radio that it just be assumed that one thing is right, because I vehemently disagree.
David, I think you will agree there that we've reached a point here where we have, 99.9% of the world scientists who say that we have to act here and who agree on the science on this. I must say, I don't know what more you need. Do you need
more? No, the science is science is very, very clear on the following things. One, that concentrations of greenhouse gases are increasing. That's measurable. That temperature is increasing. That's measurable. There's no data showing that it's been cooling. In fact, the warmest years on record are the last decade and a half. That temperatures are increasing. We can measure that. We know that emissions are increasing. We can measure that. We have very good explanations for the link between the two. And no other competing alternative explanations, many of which have been thrown out there and many of which have been explored, exist. So we know that the link is there. And you're right, 99.9% of the scientists agree to it, and that should be enough to take action. Where there is uncertainty is how rapid and how significant the impacts are. And so I would urge people who want to think about this to think about that uncertainty is important. How fast the impacts are going to be is important to how much we need to change our economy and how quickly. And I think the caller's perspective about the fact that some of the policy steps we could take could also have negative impacts
right.
is an important one. Clearly, if we shifted all of our agricultural land to forest, that would help climate change to some extent because forests absorb carbon. But that's not the primary response we need. The primary response we need is to reduce emissions. And we do have to find balance in these policies, but we have to begin with the point that climate change is happening. It's a very significant impact. We have to move on to talking about what are wise policies to address it. And there's where there's room for debate.
Thanks, Dave, very much for your call. Let's go to Michelle in Stevens Point. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for this program. I'm calling because I've gotten involved just recently in the Citizens Climate Lobby. And I did so because I'm part of a group here in Stevens Point, and there's one also in Madison that is part of a larger national effort. And we're interested in the carbon fee and dividend, a bill which was introduced in the fall of 2011 by U.S. Representative Peter Stark of California, and it had 22 co-sponsors. And it's been referred to the House and Ways Committee, Ways and Means Committee, and I'm not sure where it is just now, but groups like ours, individuals from our groups, are going to Washington and meeting directly with legislators, anyone who will talk with us, wherever they sit. If they want to talk, we'll sit down and talk with them. And the idea is that if fossil fuel companies would pay a fee based on how much carbon they will produce when their products are burned, this would make, of course, fuels more expensive, but the dividend part is that the money from the fee would be returned to every adult in the U.S., and the government would collect the fees and return the money to consumers as a rebate. Now, this group is called Citizens Climate Lobby, and if there are citizens out here who would like to get involved, they can Google us at Citizens Climate Lobby. And I wondered if your speaker, who has given us so much information internationally, is aware of this group and if he knows anything about this bill. Or
all right, David?
Yes, I don't know its current status, but I do know the fee and dividend approach, which is a very interesting and encouraging alternative to addressing an alternative to cap and trade, essentially, where we would put a fee on carbon, as the caller said, and reinvest that or return that through dividends. So, and what I think is interesting about the current political climate is, as we talk about the fiscal cliffs and how to deal with the tax system and the tax rates, it may provide a window of opportunity to talk about how we could put a tax on carbon, which would have the same impact from an environmental perspective as a cap and trade or other regulation, or could have the same impact. And we have to figure out how to do that in a way that doesn't hurt the poor the most and is equitable and fair, and the fee and dividend approach is one way to do that. I also want to say that it's very important that citizens like the caller get involved in climate and push it, push these things forward, because it's really the movements through civil society that are really what's going to build that political will to make change, both internationally and domestically.
We'll talk a little bit more about what citizens can do in a moment, because the issue can make you feel like everything's going under and let's just enjoy ourselves. David Hunter is our guest, assistant professor of law and director of the Environmental Law Program at American University's Washington College of Law. We're talking this hour about the international conference taking place as we speak in Qatar, Doha, Qatar, where representatives from the governments of almost 200 countries are meeting to look at global warming and to discuss a new treaty to succeed Kyoto. 800-486-8655 is our number. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, Doc Severinsen will be with us. He is going to be leading, conducting the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra in holiday concerts this weekend. And Mark Niehaus, who is the new president of the Symphony Orchestra, will also join us. David Hunter is here now. David, you talk about citizens becoming involved here, and let's look at this for a moment because of the enormity of this issue and because we're all feeling the effects, be it droughts or hurricanes or floods. We're seeing the effects of a warmer planet. There is a tendency to either deny the fact that this is happening or, on the other hand, say, I just can't do anything about this. It's just way too enormous. And so there are risks in both of those strategies. What is it you recommend we do? What can we do?
Well, I think you're right. I think there is a if one looks at the overall picture, it's so enormous and so complex. You think either throw up your hands or you can't. There's nothing that can be done. But I don't think that's accurate. In fact, first off, I will say that it's the international level, the civil society and individuals. One of the things, if you go to these international conventions, is the enormous number of young people and others that are organized, that are there to talk about climate change and to learn about it and also to influence the policymakers. And that happens on every level. We've been talking about the federal level, but I would also say that some of the most interesting and important initiatives are happening at the at state levels. And at local level,
mm-hmm.
you've got cities that have taken climate initiatives. You have college campuses that have agreed to go to carbon zero. You have local municipalities. And so on all those levels, and those are important because any ton of carbon that's not emitted anywhere in the world helps us address climate change. And so we have to think about this enormous problem in incremental steps. What we do in our individual lives as well as what we do in our local communities make a huge difference, from planting trees to driving a more efficient car to changing to a more efficient light bulb. And those all sound kind of quaint, but those are the building blocks on which everything else depends, frankly.
Yeah. Dorothy in Dodgeville, hi.
I would like to emphasize the fact that we need more birth control, and we need to make sure that human waste and animal waste in some countries do not regulate those pollution sources. There needs to be greater emphasis on those wastes, and that's my comment.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that when we do look at these broad issues, we recognize that population continues to grow, and that's going to add to the climate change burden. It grows in many countries where the per capita emissions are far below those of the United States. So even as we talk about population control in other parts of the world, we have to recognize that our emissions per capita are probably too high as well, and we need technologies and other things to lower our consumption of those or our emission of those wastes.
Brian in Madison, hi.
Three things. In the dialogue with the environmental skeptics, if we would change it to focus that we are contributory, not that we caused the change. Secondly, that can we have any effect, the ozone treaty documents that individual changes can have an effect. And thirdly, with respect to the legislation that was recently discussed, if the taxes that were raised by the carbon tax would be invested in alternative energy, we could have very significant change. I'll take your comments.
Thank you, Brian.
No, I agree with all those comments.
Your predictions, your hopes for what will come from this two-week conference in Doha?
Both my predictions and my hopes are modest, I would say. I think that we'll see an agreement on the second round of the Kyoto Protocol, where those countries that are wanting to continue that process, mainly Europe and Australia and a few others, will agree to a second round. And that's important because it shows their ongoing commitment, and it also keeps the architecture in place. The second part of the process that's very important is to make these building blocks towards a more global agreement. Among those, I hope that they'll be able to operationalize what we call the Green Climate Fund, which is a global mechanism for financial flows to help particularly developing countries with new technologies and to improve their efficiencies and things like that, and to address climate change. And then the third, which will be won't be a headline, but is very important, is that the countries put in place a kind of a work plan with milestones working towards this 2015 date, when that will be the next really big conference, where there will be a lot of pressure for all the countries, not just those that are in Kyoto, but all the countries to strengthen their commitments, hopefully in some kind of binding form, but at least strengthen their commitments in a way that gives us some hope that the world is united around an effort that will address the worst parts of climate change.
Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with hope. And a little bit of action, right?
Definitely with a little bit of action.
Yeah. Thanks, David, so much for being with us.
Thank you.
David Hunter, Assistant Professor of Law, Director of the Environmental Law Program at American University's Washington College of Law. He teaches U.S. environmental law, international environmental law, comparative environmental law. He is the author of the leading textbook in the field, International Environmental Law and Policy. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program. Thanks for all of your calls. We were the recipient of many, many phone calls, and we didn't get to all of them, but we'll be on this subject again, I can assure you. News is coming up, and we'll return with another hour of conversation. Should have some fun with Doc Severinsen.